From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 22nd day of June 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Eric Snodgrass will be here as usual from Agrible to take up the weather forecast for the Corn Belt and the planet. And then we'll take a look at what happened yesterday in Washington, D.C. The House of Representatives passed the Farm Bill, and a look forward to July 6th. That's kind of the deadline day for the tariff imposition on China and, of course, their retaliation. And as we wrap up our time together, we'll get a start on Commodity Week as well. If you can stay with us for the whole hour, you'll hear all of that program. Our panelists this week include Kirk Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, and Bill Mayer. And it all starts right now, right here on Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
And you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Friday afternoon. Michael Zuzulo joins us from his office in Atchison, Kansas, a global commodity analytics and consultant. Hey, good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you again, Todd. Happy Friday, sir.
Well, today is much better than it was on Tuesday. I think most of the brokers I have talked to had a really rough morning then. However, soybeans have managed to stage not a great, but a pretty good comeback.
I thought so too. 55 cents off the week's low. We did close lower on the week, but on the meal, we actually closed higher on the week. So we did some rebuilding ahead of the acreage and stocks report a week from today. And then obviously the big news will be the July 6th tariff deal, whether that goes through or not. But I think as a whole, what you saw in the market, you had some offsetting fundamentals after Tuesday's bloodbath. And most importantly was probably the Chinese and Russian wheat production news that they may lose 15 to 20% of their production versus year ago levels. And so between that and the Brazil transportation freight issues and that nightmare for them and their producers down there continuing and ongoing for over a month now. And then today, seeing the oil jumping about 5% as OPEC did raise output, but not as much as trade expectations, you had some things to soften the blow, some fresh fundamentals that helped soothe and put some salve over these trade war jitters in the short term.
Yeah, it looks to me that the cattle on feed report, which came out at 3 o'clock, might be one of those things, to at least my initial reading of it, though I am not an analyst. Tell me a little bit about that. It says inventory's what, up 4% over the June 1, 2017 report?
Yeah, that on feed up 104, top end of the range, placements at 100%, top end of the range, marketing's at 105%, top end of the range. That's all good for feeding and feed demand. Probably a tougher report for the feeders, given the fact that the on-feed and the placements were both on the top end. I haven't looked at the weight breakdown yet on the on-feed or the placements yet, but I would call it probably neutral to fat cattle, especially since we seem stabilized at 109, 110 in the cash fats around the country. The cold storage numbers also came out, Todd. They were pretty little changed when it came to the beef stocks. Pork stocks did drop about 2% versus April, but we're still running about 6% above last year at this time. So I guess I would call feeders down on Monday with the idea that to get above 150 on a close in August, feeders maybe need some fresh fundamentals to get that done.
USDA makes note in the report that this is the highest June 1 inventory since the series began, that back in 1996. I suppose when you look forward to the quarterly grain stocks report, which is a week away now, that could be good news as those cattle will be eating up a lot of corn.
Yeah, and it seems to me that, you know, based upon the people I've talked to in Chicago, it seems as though the trade is really looking at corn yield right now and looking at acreage. And so for the reports next week, it seems to me that we're really focusing more on what the winter wheat acreage number will be and what the soybean number will be in terms of acres, and not really looking at the stocks number very closely. So I would say you've got a real good point in watching for a surprise in the corn demand number domestically. And I, you know, it'd be nice to see it because we kind of need it after this week's export sales report.
You know, I kind of had forgotten about that. You reminded me that early in the year, there were a lot of wheat producers thinking this crop doesn't look very good as it made its way through the winter months. Do we think there's very much acreage out of Oklahoma, parts of south central Kansas that may have been torn up and converted to a different crop?
Yeah, I think the abandonment is there. It may not be as drastic as what I thought 2 months ago, but I do think that the yield number and the winter wheat, although USG's brought it down some, is probably too high based upon what I'm hearing getting cut at this point. So either harvested acres probably needs to drop a little bit or the yield needs to come down. But one of the things that I found out about 3, 4, or 5 weeks ago is that producers were probably going to go ahead and cut wheat for the hoping the best because yields had been able to perform better than expectations the past couple of years. Plus, they just outright needed the straw, the wheat straw, because hay prices were getting so high and in Oklahoma and Kansas in particular. So it's something, though, I think still needs to be addressed as well as the soybean acres. And we'll see what they give us on cotton and soybeans as well.
In the Corn Belt, despite the fact that those wheat acres are there and it's a tough crop, it's a high protein crop, so it's not likely to be used as feed. It'll be put into the system.
Yeah, and you know, you bring up a good point about the difference between the two crops. I talked to one of the news wires today and they said, why is the soft red wheat rallying against the hard red? Why do you have a two cent premium in soft red in the July contract? And I think part of that's the variable storage rate and how it tends to push the futures market close to delivery up and give it a little bit more premium. But I think more importantly, I think these cuts in China and Russia productions by some very well-known and respected private agencies and even the own Russian government came out today talking about 100 million ton grain crop. So you're talking about 15 to 20% below year ago levels in the global wheat crop. That does a lot of good in trimming supplies in an environment where you're worried about demand and tariffs. So I still think wheat's our leader, and technically that 495 and a half level in hard red wheat was tested this week. It was tested today. If we get a weekly close back above that, I think then you could start talking about a low being in place in the market.
You know, we've talked about all kinds of things, but as you mentioned early in our discussion, it's really about July 6th from this point forward.
You know, it really is. I just posted a new blog on the website and went back to 1993 and went back to some of the great U of I economists and Purdue economists and others that had been putting out stuff in the mid-80s to early 90s. And the exchange rate really means a lot, especially as you get more into the tall grass and the weeds as far as the production and the protectionism of domestic production. And I think this is where the market's at, is that if you see that dollar rally, you've got some issues, and it's going to look like more like the mid-1980s when you had a pretty substantial rally in the dollar. It would make sense. It would become a safe haven if we do push that button. I'm hoping this is just a negotiation tactic, as we talked about last week, because once you go down this path and press the button, it's very hard to unwrap it. And sometimes it takes years to unwrap it. And that's what happened in the mid-80s. It wasn't until the mid-90s that we started to get the Uruguay round back on track and see that trade liberalization come around again.
Well, we have 2 weeks to find out. I suppose it won't be long now. Hey, thanks, Patrick.
And thank goodness that whiskey tariff's in place, because we'll need it here in the domestic market.
That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. Mike, you have a good weekend. Sounds like you are. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, I suspect you already know that the House of Representatives passed its version of the Farm Bill, the one that it failed earlier in the year without any changes because that wasn't possible in the legislative way that it was put forth. You can learn all about the details of it and how it compares to what the Senate may pass as early as next week. Look for the Jonathan Coppas interview on the willag.org website. Again, the Farm Bill passed yesterday. That after the immigration vote for the Bob Goodlatte version of the immigration legislation had gone through and failed. That was the tougher version, the more moderate version and may yet be taken up next week, though it appears that the president is unsure whether he wants that to happen or not at this point. The other item of interest is something that came from the Beltway Beef Podcast. This is put out by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, a discussion with their Director of International Trade and Market Access, Kent Baucus, talks a bit about the impact of potential tariffs with China and what might happen with freight. In fact, a ship loaded with boxed beef has already turned around, despite the fact that tariffs aren't yet in place, says Baucus.
These tariffs are not actually supposed to go into effect till July the 6th, but that hasn't stopped, you know, businesses in China from saying, look, we don't want to pay that tariff. And so if there's a risk that that ship's not going to arrive before that deadline, you know, it's a long boat ride from the west coast of the U.S. to the east coast of China. There's a chance that the boat wouldn't arrive in time, wouldn't be offloaded in time, it could be hit with that tariff. Well, they're saying that that risk is too great. And so they've canceled orders. And so now those ships get turned around. It's not just beef that's being impacted by this. I mean, we're looking at pork. Pork is a, you know, that's a major export market for pork. And why should that matter to beef producers? Well, because pork competes directly with us in all of our major export markets. And if you think that the exports to China are not going to impact us, then you need to think again, because, like, you know, kind of like Mexico and beef, China eats a lot of the pork cuts that Americans don't want. So that's going to get displaced to other Asian markets. Oh, and guess what? Two of our top export markets are in Asia. So actually three when you include Hong Kong. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And we're not alone in the meat sector. The rest of ag is pretty nervous about this, and really the U.S. economy in general.
That's Kent Baucus, pulled from the Beltway Beef Podcast. You can find that on beefusa.org if you'd like to hear the whole of that conversation. On the subject of freight, we take that up during Commodity Week. You can hear that right here on this program today if you can stay with us on our home station, or later on over the weekend on many of these radio stations, or up on our website right now at WILLAG.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. Thanks, Eric, for being with us. Can you tell me a little bit about the system that just rumbled through? It was kind of a unique one, I believe.
Well, it was unique because we have not seen a legitimate low pressure system, you know, with a central low pressure with an upper level trough like this. I think I got to go back to April before I've seen one. So, you know, when these kind of systems come through, it's one of these things where everybody gets a drink. And so we basically just added, on top of all the rain we've had in June, a whole bunch more. And it's making June look very, very wet. So June's going to finish hot and wet because of this system. We actually had some pretty strong storms that rolled through parts of Iowa and Illinois recently too. And my folks right now are driving through right up Interstate 39 through the middle northern part of the state. And they have sent me bunches of texts saying we've seen lots of damage to corn, just corn laid down flat because of the strong winds. Now, the hope is it wasn't green snap. The hope is that it turns right back up. But, you know, we've seen some damage out of this. So we've had a lot of rain, which you think would be a great thing, but some wind damage. And we're not done. We've got another system coming on Monday. So there's while we're kind of stuck in this cooler pattern with an upper level trough, we have a second pulse coming through on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. And that's just going to be another round of rain for the Corn Belt. So we're certainly going to finish June on a wet note. And certainly it's been a stormy note, and this has been a big change, right? Up until now, it's just been thunderstorms, no big organized lows, and now we've had two of them in a row. So that has been the big pattern flip that's been of concern, and something that we had to watch.
Yeah, so I know that you watch the weather all the time. What else have you been pondering over the last several days?
Well, I'm always concerned about how we get into pollination. So we know that we're, you know, anywhere between 250 and some locations well over 300 grain degree day units ahead of normal since May 1st. And so that's allowed this crop to really grow fast. It's allowed it to, you know, to really get through its vegetative stages quickly. We got some that are going to tassel here very, very soon. We'll have a lot going to tassel before we get into the month of July. So when I start thinking about that, my thoughts immediately go to, do I see any any ridging in the middle part of the country, because if we get those temperatures back up into the upper 90s, we keep those low temperatures overnight, you know, well above 70, that's just uncomfortable for corn. And the corn plant, you know, will try to preserve itself and try to be more comfortable and not put all of its energy into making grain. So what we're watching is it looks as though by the time we get toward the end of June, the beginning of July, that we're going to be setting up a pretty decently sized ridge over the Great Lakes. This ridge will kind of extend east over the eastern United States. And then the models, both the European and the GFS, have this tracking back west with time. Now, that means we're not going to get away from the warm temperatures. It's going to be hot. Will it be stressful hot? That's up in the air. But the two things that are most important with that heat are the fact that the ridge is retreating west. That's number one. And number two, the Gulf of Mexico stays wide open. Now, what does all that mean? Well, if that ridge keeps retreating to the west, which means it's going to go right over the Corn Belt, bringing in some heat, we will get northwest flow again, which means more thunderstorms. So when I look at the long-range models, what I see out of them is a wet pattern extending, you know, into the beginning of the month of July. So more thunderstorms, hit or miss, ridge riding thunderstorms, but we got the heat, we got the moisture in the soil. So our big question is, you know, how long can we carry this with our soils right here in Illinois? You know, how long can we, if we did get dry, would it even matter at this point? So I don't see a cool pollination time period, but I do see a wet pollination time period. So that is, that's how we're going to start things off as we get into the month of July.
It'll be interesting to see the soil water holding capacity across the whole of the Corn Belt. I know here in our part of the world it's really high, but there are other places that not so much the case. You mentioned both that it will be hot and wet, and that oftentimes, especially the further south you go, causes some problems as well.
Yeah, it does. And so things I'm worried about for farmers here in Illinois and Iowa and Indiana, you know, I'm worried, you know, with this much rain, what do we do to the nitrogen in the soil? You know, I'm not a nitrogen expert, but I can at least know. I know what happens if we get a lot of rain. You know, for places that have some standing water, are we going to be getting some hypoxia issues? And with a wide open Gulf of Mexico, does that possibly push some fungal pressures farther north? I'm just saying these things to get farmers to look for it and think about it as something that's an issue. But, you know, when I look longer term, let's just go ahead. Let's talk about the rest of July and August here as we finish this up. I'm looking for good analog years. And one of them that I found that I'm going to have to spend the weekend researching is 2010. That was also a year we got ahead on growing degree days. Then June turned wet. But then things kind of shifted in the month of July, and we had some trouble with really warm overnight lows in July and August, which then took the top end off of the yields. Our analog forecasting system is not giving a clear picture. It is not. And it is certainly different from what the long-range dynamical models say. The long-range dynamical models want to dry things out in July and August, and they want to bring in some heat. The analogs want to keep everything west of the primary Corn Belt in terms of heat and drought stress. So what I'm saying is this is going to be a July where we're going to have to just every day keep a close eye on the two-week forecast. What's it saying? How are things evolving? And just remember that, you know, oftentimes when the markets sniff out rain, you know what they tend to do. So I think that'll be the major things I'm going to be watching. If you ask me, I think that the summer's going to finish warm. I think that the summer is also going to see a wide open Gulf of Mexico for most of the summer, and therefore a lot of hit or miss thunderstorm activity. So it's going to be one of those summers where, you know, some folks who don't get the storms will probably have some big yield issues. And if we're not managing our nitrogen well, and if we have some fungal pressures, that could also knock the top end off. And again, you and I, every week, we've got to be talking about these overnight lows once we get into July and August. I think that'll be key for us to watch very closely. So it's a lot. And this is one of those interesting summers that brings what you think it needs, which is the rain, but it could also bring some other troubles with it.
We'll be glad to have you helping us out to watch that. Thanks so much. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Yep, you too.
That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible.